You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 9th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex Gorovich on whose strike and what general strike. Also on the program today, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions confirmed to be the chief racist of the United States. Oh, I'm sorry. The Attorney General.
Number one priority, voting rights. Ha ha ha, just kidding.
One Democrat votes for Sessions. Joe Manchin. When he's not shooting cap and trade with a machine gun, he's installing racists. We'll see how that goes for him.
Got to be excommunicated. I don't care.
Good news. Republicans looking to make you pay more for your banking. Trump to allow U.S. companies to fund human rights abuses in the Congo.
Well, I mean, it's a big deal there. You got minerals.
Anthem acquisition of Cigna blocked. And corporate America pretending to hire more people to appease Donald Trump. Neil Gorsuch apparently been demoralized by Donald Trump. And lastly, Trump satisfying Mitch McConnell video to follow. I'm sorry, we don't have video of that.
Wow. I thought, no, yes. I didn't think you were better than that.
All that and more on today's program.
I have a cold. If it's too through the pants, it's not good.
I have a cold, and I thought that image of Mitch McConnell satisfying Donald Trump would shake the cold out of me. You know, people like will drink like a half a bottle of apple vinegar cider.
That's even worse.
That was my version of
your Orrin Hatching over here, and now. In addition to that joke.
We will get to the Alex Gorovich. I just pre-taped him half an hour ago. And it just occurred to me I probably wouldn't have had to do that since it was a snow day. Nope. And he probably didn't even have to. But we did that. My kids are at home. They were screaming and yelling when I left. Snow day, very exciting for them. They were up until, I don't know, an hour after I went to bed. I just shut the door and I said, good luck, guys. Don't burn the place down. And that was it. We've got a bunch of sound clips for you. We'll get to those later in the program. I referenced during the interview with Alex Gorovich an interview with Jennifer Palmieri on the Chuck Todd program. I'm not sure which one it was. Meet the Press Daily. Jennifer Palmieri being the former Clinton campaign spokesperson, and her just what she was saying, I think, brings up a very interesting point, and we get to it actually in the interview with Gorovich, which, you know, and maybe we should actually play this. Now, I mean, I reference it in the interview, but one of the challenges that we have, and it was one I think that we anticipated in the event that a Donald Trump would win, is that, and we've talked about this, and again, we're two or three weeks in now, but there's been a tremendous amount of protests, and we see a Democratic base, party. I don't know exactly who it is that has been particularly motivated. And like I said to Alex Gorovich in the upcoming interview, we've gotten emails and we've spoken to callers who are obviously on the left end of the Democratic Party and outside it, who have been organizing, who have been attempting to take over their local Democratic Party, who have been organizing outside of it. We don't really know what the agenda of the protesters are, and I'm not sure that they know. And we can argue over what people are protesting, but I think it's really the point is not to argue it over it at this point. The point is to channel it. And in some respects, I think Jennifer Palmieri is trying to channel it here. She may be analyzing it, but I think there's also a push to make sure that, you know, everybody wants a piece of this and everybody wants it to go in their direction. So here's Jennifer Palmieri, the former Clinton campaign communications director, arguing that the protests we're seeing are for what I have suggested at this point that they have been for, to just simply maintain the status quo that existed 5 weeks ago.
Upside, at least, to engaging with the public while Trump is president is there are things you can literally do in your own life to be supportive, to resist him, to help. And that, and I think that's empowering for people.
But what do you do to make sure you don't allow, that the movement doesn't allow a hijacking of the Democratic Party?
Because I don't believe that. I actually think the real energy is not just with the base. These are apolitical people that are turning out. These are millions of people who don't normally participate in politics, and they are scared, and they also understand. And I saw this, obviously, not as much as we needed in the election, but I saw in the fall, people, our crowds grow, the concern in the crowd, you could feel the concern in the crowds, people thinking, this country just exists because we agree to live by a certain set of rules. And it is incumbent upon me as an American to stand up and say, Donald Trump does not represent what I view America to be. And I think that a lot of this energy is not, the base is there, but you are wrong to look at these crowds and think that means everyone wants $15 an hour.
Don't assume this is
like
a policy.
Don't assume that the answer to big crowds is moving policy to the left. I think the answer to the big crowds is engaging as much as you can to be as supportive as you can and understanding. I mean, what these people want, they are desperate. It's all about identity on our side now. Mm. They want to show, he does not support me. I support you, refugee. I support you, immigrant in my neighborhood. Mm. I want to defend you. Women who are rejecting Nordstrom's and Neiman Marcus are saying this is power for them. Donald Trump doesn't take me seriously. Okay. Well, like, I'm showing you my value and my power. And I think it's like our own version of identity politics on the left that's more empowering. And I think that's a safer place to be. Mm.
I think some of this is accurate analysis. It's also incredibly sad in my mind that the idea that women are expressing their power by getting Nordstrom's to remove a product line. I mean, I think, yeah, look.
It's amazing she worked on the Clinton campaign.
The Clinton campaign
was very substantive and certainly not built around vague signifiers.
And that's why, you know, this interview, Alex Gorovich and I get to this question of what needs to happen, because she concedes the base is there. And then there's all these other people. And the question is, can you get these other people, to actually start to contemplate the idea of policy? And I think we're a couple of weeks away from starting to see, you know, the onslaught of Republican policy that may provide that impetus. Because, yes, Donald Trump is a disgusting human being, and it's disgusting that he's president, and his executive orders are contrary to our values. But I think also so is Republicans just deciding we're going to re-raise bank rates. We're going to take the restriction. We're going to attack the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to starve public education of funds. We're going to destroy labor regulations, labor laws. environmental protections. These are Republicans doing this. Donald Trump doesn't know his ass from his elbow with this stuff. His entire agenda is a function of Republican politics.
And personal enrichment.
And personal enrichment.
Yeah, but that's his
but that's like number five on the list, right? Yeah. Of things that we should be worried about.
Absolutely.
But so there may be some truth to what Jennifer Palmieri is saying, but that truth is not static.
She might be right descriptively, but not proscriptively, hopefully.
Well, I think she's wrong proscriptively.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that
is a snapshot. Yes, I think there is a lot of people in these protests who have not engaged in politics before, but it's not sustaining to say for 4 years that Donald Trump is a horrible human being. That's not going to be enough. You're actually going to have to get proactive about stuff.
I do look forward to the Cory Booker fast in front of Nordstrom's. Gandhi retail.
He's going to go right in front of their cafe.
Yeah.
Just you got to do what's right. You got to be progressive.
Strap himself.
Now, I love Nordstrom's. It's a wonderful company, but I'm going to be doing a juice fast like Mahatma Gandhi.
So I got myself into work today, crawled out of bed, but there's nothing harder than getting out of a Casper mattress. We only have one in the house, but I think we're about to get a second one. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Supportive memory foams create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. For me, this is the selling point. I mean, now I have one, and now it's the most comfortable bed we have in the house. It's not mine. It's Saul's, sadly, but you can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada. They ship it to you in a box. I don't know how they do that. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars. It's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. You can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/majority. That's casper.com/majority using offer code majority. Terms and conditions apply. Really incredibly comfortable mattress. The other thing that's making my house a little bit more peaceful. Fine, you give your wife a watch. And, you know, it helps. And what better gift? I don't know if you get it. Could you get it in time for Valentine's Day at this point?
I think so.
I don't know. But you know what? If you took a picture of it off the internet and showed it to her, or him, for that matter.
Like, it's coming your way soon. Happy right. Valentine's Day.
I've done that with pictures. I mean, I've done that with gifts.
I bet you have.
Yeah, that happens. Does that not happen in most families?
Nope.
Our families. Well, I'm not the only person who does it. There's been a lot of times I just got a piece of paper as a gift, and it's like, it should be here in about 2.5 weeks. Started by two broke college kids that wanted to wear stylish watches but couldn't afford them. Movement, MVMT watches, was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. I mean, this is where the future is, right?
Style should not break the bank. It should be accessible.
You don't want to go to exactly.
You shouldn't go to a department store.
Exactly.
It's a small business.
By selling their products entirely online, Movement was able to cut out the middleman and retail markup in order to provide you with the best price possible watches, just starting at $95.
That is an incredible deal.
It's a fraction of what department stores typically charge. You could not pay me $95 to even go into a department store at this point.
Agreed.
This revolutionary pricing of Movement's classic design, quality construction, styled minimalism has led to over 500,000 watches being sold in 160 countries. Nikki, I think, is wearing hers right now. I don't know if she is, but I think she is. So step up your watch game. People have watch games?
Step up your watch game. Stop being a prick. Get styled minimalism.
Game. What does that mean, watch game?
It's your watch game. It's, what's the matter
like
with
your
you?
Golf game. Just
no, it's not overall. Like your golf game. It's like your coat game.
Stam,
it's
stop being
a coat game.
Stop. You don't have any
He doesn't
game.
Have any game.
I got no game.
He's a schmuck.
No, I mean, I understand why you want to wear a nice looking watch.
I have 5 different coats, you know.
What?
Yeah. Well,
for different seasons.
Well, no, because Trump won and I bought coats.
All 5 seasons, oh, yes, geez. Exactly.
It's complicated, seriously? But I have a coat game. It might not be good, but it's, you know.
Well.
The point is they're great watches and they're incredibly cheap.
Go to MVMTwatches.com/majority. That's MVMTwatches.com/majority. Get 15% off today, plus free shipping and free returns. That's MVMTwatches.com/majority. Join the movement.
Don't All be right. a schmuck.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Alex Gorovich on Whose Strike. We are back. Sam Seder on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Alex Gorovich. He is an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science at Brown University, author of From Slavery to the Cooperative Commonwealth, Labor and the Republic and Republican Liberty in the 19th Century. The writer of the piece Whose Strike, which you may have seen on Current Moment or a couple other places, including The Jacobin. Welcome to the program, Alex.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, all right, let's talk about this because as far as I know, there has been multiple general strikes called for over the course of the next, 6 weeks, really. I've heard February 17th. I've heard May Day. I've heard a couple of dates in between. Give us a sense of what the genesis of this is. I mean, obviously, there's a tremendous amount of dissent of the election at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit hard to follow because, as you mentioned, there are a bunch of different general strikes being called. It's not clear who's calling them always. There doesn't seem to be much coordination. They seem to be factions splitting from factions to call their own general strike. So I don't know all the ones actually have been called. There's at least 3 I know of. And, I mean, they seem to be a product of the last few really heady weeks of protests against the Trump administration and what's turning out to be the kind of Trump-Bannon-Ryan agenda. And, yeah, you know, the last 2 weeks have been, I think, have exceeded the expectations of a lot of people. I mean, these protests were bigger than people expected. They were more effective than people expected. I think it's not just the size, but they seem to have been effective in turning back or, you know, compromising or limiting Trump's ability to do some things. I think it was most notably the immigration ban, but also sort of, you know, it seemed to make it harder for him to confirm his nominees. It seems to be reversing public opinion on some of the big ticket legislative issues like Affordable Care Act, smaller things like mass sell-off of land, you know, public lands. So, you know, these big protests seem to be effective, especially when they're really able to disrupt things like they were at the airports when the immigration ban was announced. And so I think there's this understandable desire to want to kind of intensify and escalate. And I think that in one sense, that's where the call for a general strike is coming or coming from. Well, the piece that I wrote was, yeah,
Let's put a pin in that right now. Let's go back to you cover the history of general strikes in this country. Let's talk about that for a little bit, because we haven't had one, as far as I know, since I think it was 47 in Oakland, maybe, in this country. And you made the point in your piece that the United States has the most violent labor history of any major industrial country. Is that true? Yeah. I hadn't really contemplated it, but that's pretty striking. No pun intended, I guess.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about strikes without using that word. It is true. I mean, labor historians have known this for a long time. Comparative studies of sort of domestic violence, violence inside a country against its own citizens and population show it. In comparison with any country industrializing over the same period of time, so say roughly the end of the Civil War to say World War II, the United States had by far the most violent labor history. And by violent, this primarily means violence committed by agents of the state against striking workers. So you have things like National Guardsmen using machine guns, machine gunning down, striking miners in Colorado and in West Virginia. You have the use of military airplanes to bomb strikers who are striking railroads. The origins of the militarization of the police in the United States begin with their adoption or with them acquiring the role of strike breakers in the late 19th century. So the first police forces were just like doing, arresting basically drunks and prostitutes. But once you start getting mass strikes in the 1870s, they become the first line of strike breaking defense once the kind of employers' own militias turned out to be too weak to do that. And they get rifles, they get military training, they become organized as separate military, sort of militarized officials in the cities. And then in any of the big strikes, when police and National Guard couldn't put it down, then the federal troops came in. And you see that 1877, 1886, 1894, you see that in 1919 during some of the big strikes, in the 1930s. There's photographs, 1960s in the Memphis strike, which Martin Luther King is assassinated when he goes to Memphis to support the strike, and he's actually calling for a general strike. There are tanks in the streets. And they're there in part for strike suppression. So the United States has an extraordinarily violent labor history.
What do you think accounts for that? Because I had never even heard of the Ludlow Massacre, for example, I looked that up, just read a little bit about it. It's stunning. I mean, the idea of a National Guardsman I guess we have incidences like this through our history on some level, but the idea of them just taking a machine gun to a tent colony of this wasn't in the process of strikers trying to bust through the gates of some factory or something. I mean, they were just in a tent colony with their families and they opened fire. What accounts for this level of violence, A? And B, does it indicate the stakes that are actually involved in this?
Right. That's a really important question. I think the first thing that accounts for this violence is that these strikes were very threatening to the power of employers and sometimes the state. I mean, these were, sometimes very large, that could involve hundreds of thousands of workers, or when you had these sort of mining strikes, although they were sort of local and smaller, they were very, very popular among the workers. You had near total participation, and it really threatened the economic fortunes of very lucrative businesses. And then in these sort of larger scale strikes, like in the 1930s or 1894 Pullman strike, I mean, that's a strike that goes across, ends up leading to martial law being declared basically from Chicago to Los Angeles to put it down. These are very threatening strikes because they were very large scale. They were solidaristic. You had a lot of sympathy and it reached across immense differences in language and ethnicity and sometimes race. So I think the first reason for the violence was that it was very threatening. The second was that the judiciary and more broadly labor law was extremely hostile to workers. So by the 1890s, basically what happens is that judges just start issuing these injunctions against strikes. And it means that a lot of what we associate with strike activity, like mass picketing, boycotting, marching, protesting, becomes, you know, assembly just becomes illegal. And the mass suppression of, you know, mass suppression of civil liberties. And it means then that strikers are not just striking against their employers, but they suddenly become basically mass civil disobedience. They're now in conflict directly with the state because there's no way for them to go on strike without violating
Once the courts get involved, it changes the strike. The strikers don't change their orientation, but once the court becomes involved, all of a sudden, our government sort of envelops the management, the capitalist, the company at that point.
That's right. I mean, this is the state acting as the agent for the employers, and you know they regularly sought to actually get injunctions because they hoped to turn these conflicts between strikers and employers into conflicts with the state. Because they could say, look, now they're criminals, or look at them, they're, you know, they're disobeying the law, it's anarchical.
The companies and, are, in some sense, externalizing the costs and the responsibility of essentially coercing their workers.
Totally. No, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the interesting things in development of the police and all this stuff is that originally in the 19th century, the companies preferred to just use their own private security guards because they paid their salaries and directly controlled what they did. But once these worker organizations got too big and they would kind of defeat the local security guards or these private, basically paid assassins of the employers, couldn't really break the strikes, they had to turn to sort of more official, nominally democratic agencies like the police and the troops and the courts. And the courts were the courts have always been very hostile to labor rights. I mean, it's notable even after the big New Deal legislation that, you know, extended some basic rights to organize and strike to workers, the courts, especially Supreme Court, very severely qualified those rights by the end of the 1940s. And notably, the Warren Court never had a real labor rights moment. I mean, we think of the 60s as this kind of moment when the courts kind of turn more liberal, but what they don't really do is turn more liberal much. There's not much extension or improvement in the labor rights of workers. So a lot of things...
And certainly we haven't had any since that era in terms of improving labor's rights. All right. Well, so let me ask you this. So I'm aware of the Hormel strike, and has there been anything? Do we have examples? I mean, on some level, right? Strikers, labor, in many respects, not totally, but in many respects, have lost that have lost those muscles. Those striking muscles, in part because of Taft-Hartley and so-called reforms, I guess, really curtailments of worker rights over the past 60, 70 years. But so has the state lost those muscles relative to strikers? I mean, we've seen the example of, like, you know, in Ferguson, where the state seems to have those muscles when it comes to corralling protesters and particularly African American protesters. But do they still have those muscles when it comes to, you know, labor stoppages and sort of circling back to this idea of a general strike? I guess one of the arguments you make here is that the people calling for the strike don't really fully understand the stakes. And to a certain extent, what is the problem with calling for a general strike right now, in addition to those calling for it don't understand the stakes? Because you're not just arguing that, like, hey, people are going to get beat up or shot by the National Guardsmen. I mean, you made the point of some people calling for the strike are like, only do this if you're not going to get fired. Well, if you're not going to get fired, on some level, it You're not speaking to the bulk of the working class.
I just speak
to this because to a certain extent we're in a very strange moment where I think the protests have been effective, particularly for the reasons you mentioned, but also in terms of changing the course of the strategy of the Democrats in the Senate in particular, but I would imagine also in the House, but less so. There was less movement to be had there. But the other interesting thing is, it seems to me, is that there is the opportunity to conflate, and I don't know if anybody knows the answer to this, to conflate what's happening in terms of these protests, to conflate the idea that they are anti-Trump with they are pro-labor, pro-$15 minimum wage. I mean, we have a clip we're going to play later in the program of Hillary Clinton's the spokesperson on TV yesterday making making the explicit argument that this is not about politics in some ways. Speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, one way to ask is, what is the point of this this new emerging movement? Is it just about getting rid of Trump? Or is it supposed to be the foundation of a new progressive politics? If it's about just getting rid of Trump, then, you know, fine, there's a lot of awful stuff he's doing. But, and I think that's basically what Jennifer Palmieri is thinking. But then the central role of this movement is just to somehow rehabilitate the Democratic Party as it has been and give it some energy to kind of stop the worst excesses of what Trump's doing. But if it's supposed to be like a properly progressive movement, then it has to ask itself some pretty serious questions about, first of all, what's the class basis of progressive politics in the United States? Now, the class basis, there's just no progressive movement without a large majority of the working class at its core. But the call for the general strike shows no particular interest in labor issues. It's kind of a weird grab bag of things. I think it was something like, don't attack health, Obamacare, stop building pipelines, somewhat bizarrely asking Trump to release his tax returns, but notably no mention of any of the central things that might appeal to workers. So no mention of 515, you know, minimum wage of a national minimum wage of $15 an hour. No mention of Trump's terrible labor secretary pick. No mention of the fact that they're going to that they're proposing national right to work legislation, which would even further weaken unions. And notably there, the guy who's spearheading that is not Trump. It's actually Mike Pence. I mean, one can imagine that one function of some kind of movement like this, including some kind of general, I don't know, protest, doesn't really deserve the name strike, but protest, would be to make it so hard to govern with Trump that he's somehow forced out. And then you just end up with Pence. But Pence is the guy who's leading national right to work legislation. If we really are trying to think about big mass protests as the beginning of developing a serious progressive movement, and one that maybe could even form itself into a party able to impose a progressive agenda, then I have to think about its class basis, but then I have to take seriously what the concerns are of the working class instead of sort of call for a general strike that at once ignores class issues and I think some of the organizers or proposers of this know this, basically exempts the working class from participating in it. Because if you stand to risk losing your job, you don't have to participate in it. Well, who does that leave? I mean, I think it leaves basically people who aren't employed. People have very secure employment and have enough control over their time that they can go out on strike, which is basically, I don't know, some elements of the liberal professions.
Right.
But that's never been a suitable basis for a progressive politics. It's not even a general strike. You know, a general strike is, and always has been, a mass work stoppage by workers. So I think
The beauty is now is we can all go out there and still have our smartphones and still be productive on strike during the general strike.
Yeah. Right.
Let me circle back though. Let me just question a couple of things that you've just talked about.
Sure.
I mean, one is the value of this is not just, I mean, there is an argument that if you make it hard for Trump to govern, that it doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be removed anywhere. I mean, I am of the school of thought that it's highly unlikely he's going anywhere. There was a piece, interview with Mitch McConnell, I guess, yesterday in the Times, where Mitch McConnell, you know, almost can't contain his excitement. Because he, sure. you know, yeah. he's getting it. This is sort of the classic getting their cake and eating it too, right? I mean, the Donald Trump is getting all the slings and arrows because he's Donald Trump, and you know, and rightfully so. Meanwhile, the Republicans are already starting with like making immigration, you know, cutting back on immigration. They're getting rid of. Of the law that prevents bank fees, for God's sakes. Yeah. I mean, just spitting in the face of consumers without anybody paying attention. But so on one level, it's making it hard for Trump to govern could be the most effective strategy in terms of slowing the roll of legislation from a Republican Congress, because, you know, Trump could end up being the gum. You know, gumming up the works, right? On one level.
Yeah.
But the other, I mean, address that. But then I also want to just ask if, you know, you said, but if it's supposed to be in terms of like this movement, is it, who determines what it's supposed to be? A, right. And B, is it really a static thing? I mean, it very well, you know, I think there's a very strong argument that if you look at the posters that were being carried, you know, in the day after the inauguration, that much of that was held over from the Clinton campaign, you know, love Trump's hate and wearing the, you know, women's power hats and the shape of vaginas. I'm not sure, but which is, you know, so that's the starting point, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's the end point.
Yeah. I agree with that. It certainly doesn't mean that's the end point, but it does mean that if all we do is keep kind of mobilizing the same crowd, rather than trying to organize new people into a much larger social movement with a different sort of class and political basis, if we don't do that hard work, and it's a different kind of political work, then it really is just going to be something like what we ended up with 2008, after everybody's so sick and tired of Bush, we end up with sort of the Obama and the existing Democratic Party. And right now, that seems to me the most likely outcome. I mean, there is a problem, as you say, of less leadership here. There's both the problem of less leadership and of creating the kind of social basis for a mass movement of really progressive change. Because I had the same experience going to the protest, the women's march, was sort of observing how much it just looked like a bit of a rehash from the election. And although it was huge, and it was exciting that it was huge, and it's also been exciting that there has been some gumming up of the works. The question is whether this can develop into something or whether that's all it ends up doing. And that's where I think the issues of whether one's going to engage in the harder work of organizing particular working class constituencies, really kind of doing the longer, slower, harder boring of strong boards, that isn't just about kind of getting, you know, the excitement out on a particular Saturday and feeling like you're going on a general strike, but actually is sort of a long, harder political game. That's the question for anyone who cares about developing a real sort of progressive politics. That's the question. There's some people who don't care about that. Jennifer Palmieri clearly only wants these movements to be a kind of stage army for the rehabilitation of her wing of the most conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Doesn't even want there to be, you know, $15 minimum wage.
Right.
And the problem is, I mean, here's the issue is, the more we let this just be about Trump, the harder it becomes to then challenge those people. So the issue is, yes, we do want to gum up the works. Yes, we want to stop Trump from doing, you know, as many terrible things as he's trying to do. But if that becomes the one thing that crowds out all criticism and everybody's supposed to just sort of be quiet and fall in line and not open up any other issues or develop any other criticisms, you know, then there's a real problem.
Can you do both at the same time? Can you do both? Is that less clear to us on how one could do that, because we have yet to sort of really move into, you know, so far we've been in, you know, and it's only been, for God's sakes, I mean, it feels like it's been forever, but it's been it's been 3 weeks, and not even. And we're moving, but within a couple of weeks, we're going to move from Trump the personality to a large extent into more, you know, the legislative, the statutory, like the policy implications. And it seems to me that's the opportunity to start to feed, you know, I mean, and I guess the question is, like, you know, what's the order in which this happens? And are they mutually exclusive at times, and how do you avoid it being mutually exclusive so that you can take the energy that exists that is anti-Trump and in some ways transfer it and educate it to be anti these policies that we're going to get coming down the road, and then pro policies that would be a better, I guess, replacement, or, you know, by fighting those policies, by providing a better image, a vision of what our society should be?
I mean, I think it's true. You can be against some things, but the question is, what are you for, and what are you winning people, trying to win people to? And if you don't, the problem for the left is that, you know, what do we have that we can win people to in terms of set of ideas and an organization that's able to bear those ideas? So, you know, you might be for universal health care, a jobs program, mass spending, public education, you know, some mass social democratic program, you know, aggressive enforcement of civil rights, you know, and so on. But, you know, who are you and who am I? So there needs to be some kind of organization that's really able to take credit for some of these movements and for those ideas and really win them to them. And that's where there is a kind of question of where efforts are best spent. And if all the efforts are going just into sort of big mass protests that are sort of grand acts of refusal, but then don't lead to the creation of the organizations and the expansion of the kind of class basis of these movements, then all we end up doing really is just delegitimizing the Republicans and then leaving the door open for just the return of the Clinton Democrats. So that's sort of why I'm thinking there's people doing stuff already. I mean, you know, you mentioned, well, labor action and labor militancy has been weighed down, and that's absolutely true, but there have been some pretty exciting, less well-known but important activities, things like the Verizon strike was a very promising strike. During the Democratic primaries, there's been some very interesting and important radical actions by teachers in Seattle and Chicago. And those, just as a kind of organizing model, I mean, those were strikes by teachers that came out of, you know, years of planning by a core of radical organizers within those unions that also made efforts to win local support before they actually went on strike. And they were high risk. They could have lost. I mean, they had to break laws. You also have to remember that, you know, these kinds of things that put pressure on people, they break laws. And but they were only able and confident to do that because they'd really kind of spent the time organizing it. And so those are sort of local. They're not as large, but they are ways of creating in cell form the kinds of capacities and organizations you can win people to that are actual alternatives.
I suspect that, I mean, just based upon the emails that I'm getting, that there's a lot more activity happening on the ground that we have yet to really had an opportunity to assess across the country. Because, I mean, I'm getting, you know, sort of, it's all anecdotal, but I'm getting emails from people who are going to you know, either DSA organizing, Democratic Socialists of America organizing around the country, but also people who are you know, writing me from Pennsylvania, people who are writing me from Minnesota saying, we just took over our Democratic Party, our local Democratic Party. Yeah. And I got to imagine that the people who are doing that, at least certainly the people I'm getting hearing from, but I imagine the people who are actually going out to do that will tend to be on the progressive end of the spectrum. And we will start to see a crop of at least electeds on some level who have those progressive ideals. And then I guess the question is like, do we start hearing from them? I mean, and certainly, you know, we have we've had an increasing amount, to the extent that we've had any sort of union phenomena that's been going on. It has been the social action unionism. I think it's a matter of time till we see that that's bubbling up. But so do you think there will be a time over the next couple of years where a general strike may actually be something that we're ready for?
Well, let me say two things. First, just on whether general strike, I mean, the other thing about general strikes is they've never really been called. Like, general strikes happen as sort of quasi-spontaneous intensifications and radicalizations of labor actions that are already underway. So there just really isn't, there aren't really any good examples, very few good examples of general strikes that were like called. We can say, now we're ready to do it, let's do it. They happen because there's already like developed patterns of militancy that are happening kind of in many different places. There have been sort of long building ties of solidarity and mutual support. And then, people just, there is kind of mass expression of it. So, you know, even, who knows? Some point, maybe we'll get there. But even the way we think about that kind of situation, I think, isn't quite the same thing as like a Facebook group calling for like a general strike on a particular day. But the second thing I'd say is, you know, I've seen the same stories about growth in DSA membership, and then, you know, the Sanders crowd taking over the Democratic Party in California, which was kind of a big deal, and the leadership struggles. But that just dramatizes the issue, which is at some point when there's any meaningful or probably plurality of meaningful sort of progressive movements out there, they're going to have to open up a second front, right? I mean, it isn't going to be enough to just be against Trump or even be against the Republicans. There's going to be a struggle for who is the best and clearest representative of a progressive politics. And then we're going to have the fight. People are going to say, we don't have time. Everybody, you know, we can't have that kind of fight right now. We first have to defeat the Republicans. We're going to face a version of the lesser evil politics that kind of failed during the election, right? Which is, no, you know, don't run Sanders or don't support Sanders or don't be left because you're just weakening, you know, the current candidates and so on. And those kinds of fights are unavoidable. They might need to be, you know, there's questions of timing. I agree. You know, but it will, at the very moment where there is actually enough energy behind that kind of a politics, it's not going to be enough for us to just answer the question, what's the best way to resist Trump or defeat the Republicans? There's going to have to be fights over who really can claim the mantle of being really the bearer of a progressive politics of equal freedom for all. And that's going to be a fight. I think it's being an ugly one. I mean, look, you know, Hillary and her crowd, they put $20 million into some big anti-populist democratic kind of organization. That's like their big initiative after the election.
Well,
they're ready for that fight.
Yeah.
You know, Jennifer Palmieri is ready for the fight.
Right.
You know,
it's true. All right. Alex Gorevich.
Those fights are going to be there. Sorry.
Yeah. Indeed. Alex Gorevich, the piece we will link to, Whose Strike. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun talking.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half, wherein we will take your phone calls and play some sound, and I will cough and perhaps sneeze. That's the plan for today. And I will blow my nose. But for people who are listening on audio, they're not. I think I've been doing a pretty good job of hiding the nose blowing. Yeah. If you're watching on YouTube, If you can properly guess the number of times I will blow my nose on camera today, we will send you a sticker. So.
We won't
really, actually.
Psych.
I mean, what we'll do is we'll see what all the guesses are, and then I will blow my nose one more time so that we don't have to send a sticker. But
it's not true. You got the number wrong.
That's right.
See?
Sorry.
Hello?
646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, you can become a member of the Majority Report, which means that you will receive the entire podcast, the full show, without commercials, on your podcast listening device. People have all sorts of different devices today that they use for podcasts, not like the back in the old days, where if you wanted to listen to your podcast, you actually had to go out and buy a cassette recorder and then hope that someone had recorded it and then get a bootleg version of the cassette. But now you can listen to the podcast on many different devices. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off your coffee, tea, or chocolate. There was a time where you couldn't use coupon codes because there was no internet and there was no place to put those coupon codes in. So
let's get to the fun half.
Yeah, I'm not feeling well. I'm heavily medicated. We'll be right back.